Well, here we are in Collins Street in Melbourne, up the top of Collins Street, which is where I meet Robin Crowe. Hello, Robin.
Hi, how are you, Jonathan?
Robin has a new book called Melmo. What's that about?
It's about modernism in Melbourne in the post-war years, where everything changed and all the influences from America were seen in our architecture.
An amazing moment, I mean, of a city, of a country, or I guess the world, pulling out of the World War, beginning to feel expansive.
Yes, and America was starting to dominate the whole world, and the big start point for architecture was the United Nations building in New York. Huge glass curtain wall building, and that sort of influenced a lot of design in other parts of the world.
Well, speaking of glass, we hear
Coates building,
called the Coates 20. Building. And yes, there is glass aplenty with protruding air conditioning units, which may not have been part of the original concept.
No, it wouldn't have been. Air conditioning was still an expensive item, but they realised as soon as they started building glass curtain wall buildings that there was an issue with climate control.
Albeit that this is south facing, but even so.
Even so, yeah.
So tell us about this building. Why special?
Actually, this is one of two buildings up this end of Collins Street. This was from 1956. It was 13 storeys, so it was quite a substantial building back then. And steel framed and glass fronted, and we can see the glass panels here. And what this represented was a change to regulations where there didn't have to be any fire retardant spandrels between windows, so you could just have a whole face of windows or glass windows. So it was.
Was that controversial?
The whole design of curtain wall buildings was controversial in some ways. I mean, some people just hated it. The people who loved the traditional styles just hated it just because they could. But there were a lot of architects who were saying, if you put a lot of glass in, you're going to increase your costs of running the building because you're going to have to put air conditioning in and all sorts of things like that.
I mean, it's an interesting place that we're at here in Collins Street. We're, what, three buildings up from the Melbourne Club.
Yes.
We are just down from the old Treasury building. We're surrounded by the still sort of luminous relics of that gold rush period of Melbourne, and yet here we have modernity poking in like sort of gaps in a row of teeth.
I hadn't thought of it like that, but yes, you're quite right. Yes.
So it would have. I don't know what was here before, but this.
Not sure. The other interesting thing about it is there was a row of seven shops in the ground floor.
Yep.
And that was starting to be a common device. It sounds strange to us, but in those days it was a little bit unusual to build glass fronted buildings with shops in the front.
Well, the thing that we now appreciate the significance of to deliver that sort of human scale on the footpath is an important thing.
That's right. Yes, that's quite right. And the architect here was a bloke called John LaGersh, and he went to America to study these sorts of buildings before he came back. So in some ways, it was quite a groundbreaking building.
But you can see why this appeals to the sort of the modernist eye. I mean, it is utter simplicity in its way. It's a very plain form.
Yeah, it's sterile simplicity, but a lot of people loved it. Robin Boyd loved it.
Well, the key anti-featurist.
Yes, that's true. And then other people like one of the Lindsays, I think it was Darrell Lindsay, thought these buildings were terrible, absolutely awful, and should be torn down straight away. Well, that didn't happen.
And yet here they are.
Here they are, 60-something years later.
I guess a testament to what, I wonder? I mean, it's not necessarily to their aesthetic appeal, but as an enduring piece of construction.
Yes, well, some people love the aesthetics of it. It's suffered a little bit through COVID, of course, but everything else in the city has too.
But Engels Espresso Cafe is locked up despite its ideological appeal, clearly.
Yes, that's right. And espresso cafes played a major role in Melbourne in this period. We had a whole lot of European migrants came here. They congregated where their fellow countrymen were. And so we ended up with cafes like Pellegrini's, The Legend in Bourke Street.
Again, modernist gestures in their own way.
They were, because the materials that were being used in there were very, very stylish and colourful. And they were serving coffee and pasta and gelato and all of these things.
Oh, a new world.
It was a new world. Yes. And particularly after the Olympics. And Melbourne embraced it, of course, and we've had a coffee culture ever since.
It's interesting because your previous book before this dealt with the Art Deco period in the city. And so we see there that, you know, the rhythms of taste, I guess, but of also, you know, movements in style and the theories there, but, you know, over time.
Yeah, what I like is change, and we've had two major areas of change in Melbourne since the 1920s, the Deco era and the modernist era. So I thought it was important to get that documented as far as I could.
All of which in this CBD being built, as we've said, in one of the great extant 19th century cities as well.
That's right, yes, yes.
Which is not to everyone's taste.
But it's the same with every aspect of architecture. There's always someone who doesn't like the style or wants to replace it or sees the difficulties with it. But I'm just glad that this one's still here.
It's a terrific, I mean, and it's another thing too, of that wonderful thing of just stopping and looking.
Yes.
In the city.
Yes, yes.
And you'd be amazed at what you might find.
And it's easy to walk past buildings like this.
It's not assuming, is it?
No.
Yeah.
No.
All right, let's wander down.
Okay.
A Collins Street stroll. We've now wandered down to number 100 in Collins Street, just down past Cartier. Over the road from Van Cleef & Arpels.
So this is Gilbert Court, number 100, and this was one of the first, if not the first, that tended to be called a glass box, and it was an easy disparaging comment, if you like, about the structure. Fully glass fronted, reinforced concrete, but unlike the other one that we saw up at the Coates building, this is on a corner. So there's a link or a connection to be made with the United Nations building in New York, albeit on a vastly different scale.
You can see the resonance there, though, between the style of the two.
That's right. Aluminium glazed curtain walls, symbolic of the post-war recovery because money was starting to be available. Building materials had been scarce for a number of years, and building restrictions had been lifted as well, so there was this emphasis. We still had height limits up until 1958, which were a major impediment, if you like, to tall buildings. But this is 12 stories. It was still under the height limit.
It's a good size, 12 stories, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
It's almost human. It's a bank now on the ground floor,
which is why they put the bollards in.
Okay, but it is as was constructed.
Pretty much so. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I imagine the glass has got a bit bigger, but apart from that,
a bit bigger and a bit thicker, probably. Yeah. So this is another elegant little building, and this is the start of the glass box syndrome in Melbourne, if you like.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's an advertisement for what?
New design.
Well, new design, but it's a good building.
Yeah.
And a good building fits into its streetscape.
Anywhere.
Regardless of what surrounds it and what surrounds this, there's a late 19th century building to the upper end of the street. Yeah. There's a 20th century, sort of this Queen Annie kind of thing next to it.
Yeah, this isn't a glaring building. This isn't going to get in anybody's face except those who didn't
but
like
it. But it's well done.
But it's well done, yeah.
And again, just around the corner at Alfred Place is what, at that time, would have been the legendary Mietta's almost, that
I think it
restaurant
was.
And carousing spot.
It's hard to remember sometimes
so
what was there. So many places that we all went to.
It is a really nice example of good taste fitting in to a streetscape, I think.
Yeah, that's right, I agree.
Enhancing it.
Yeah. Okay, the cinema centre.
Yeah, up in Bourke Street now.
designed 1966 by a guy called Peter Mueller, and he was from Sydney, and it's quite unusual for Sydney architects to practice in Melbourne and vice versa.
It used to be a law, wasn't there?
If there was, he ignored it. It included a two-level podium. I don't remember if you ever went to the movies there. Some people think it's Asian inspired. Others think it's Frank Lloyd Wright inspired. But the interesting thing
it's
about
got that
it
sort of vaguely pagodary kind of feel.
It tapers down. So you look at it and you think, oh yeah, it's an Asian building. So it's concrete, and there are touches of a brutalist finish in there, where they've used boards in the form of the concrete.
Yep.
So they're still there. There's not much else left. It's been significantly altered. But it was an interesting collection of buildings, as well as a cinema, for quite a long time.
It's interesting. It is interesting to see sort of a big brutalist chunk in the middle of that streetscape.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit. Cities all around the world. Of course, the cinema was such an important part of life in Melbourne, and particularly in the 60s, because we were moving away from city cinemas to drive-ins. This is another thing that we imported from America, and the drive-in had a very, very special resonance for those of us who grew up in the era.
Coming with the adoption of the car.
That's right. Yeah, and they're all linked, all of those things. So in the Deco era, you had the introduction of electricity, which changed things. In the 60s was the take-up of the car. And that enabled also, not just in the city, but it enabled areas like Dandenong and Clayton to develop huge industrial complexes, again, funded by American companies, Heinz, General Motors, etc., because people could drive to it, or they financed railway stations into those complexes.
Yeah, the structure so underneath
Victoria
is changing hugely.
Australia's leading manufacturing state in the 50s and 60s. So,
all right, what's next on our list?
Okay.
If this was 1964, we could be Beatles fans.
I was there on the day, like about 2 million other people claim to have been. This was the site where the Southern Cross was. And this was
Southern Cross Hotel.
This is a wonderful example of that over-the-top, garish, if you like, hotel design from the 60s. The designer was an American called Welton Becket, and he had done a lot of these hotels around the world, and there's very much a Waikiki feel to it. So totally different to
the Waikiki end of Exhibition Street.
That's right, yeah. And totally different to the rest of the hotels around Melbourne. And this was the former market site. So we had two market sites. We had the Eastern Market, which is this one, and the Western Market down Collins Street, which then became transformed into the National Mutual building.
It's interesting that the Southern Cross, of course, is no more, and in its place we see a large edifice.
Another glass box, yeah. The thing with a lot of these buildings is you can like the buildings that have been constructed recently. Sometimes you think, though, if only they'd put it somewhere else and left what was there.
Which goes to the way in which people prize or don't prize stuff from this modernist, this mid-century modern period.
Yeah, that's right.
Which tends to be treated from a sort of a preservation point of view as fairly disposable architecture.
You're right, but thankfully that's changing. And so the City of Melbourne has now got some more heritage controls that are coming in. There's heritage groups like ours that are paying a lot more attention to these buildings. So this was demolished in 2003. And if it was still there and they were trying to do it now, there'd be a huge fight.
Yeah.
But in 2003, there wasn't.
But it's a period which just in the last decade, really, has sort of come into its own.
Yeah, that's right. And this was a wonderful place for young people to come into the city. It had a fountain in the centre. It had a bowling alley. It had...
That's right, a bowling alley. I remember that.
Yeah, it had a milk bar that was very American. So we all headed straight for the... Southern Cross when we came into the city in those days, and it had a huge ballroom. So this is where all this is where things like the Brownlow Medal Night were.
It's a lost moment for this.
It is. I mean, this is a building that lives in the memory of many of us, particularly those who were here to see the Beatles. And I just think it's sad that all we've got of some of these buildings is just memories.
That's better. All right, the corner of Nicholson and Albert. This is where we find what was the ICI building.
Now the Orica building, and this is a groundbreaking building in Melbourne's architectural history, because this is the building that broke the height limits. After that, it was almost open slather on building tall buildings. But this was the first.
As you say, that the trade-off, some open space just to the northern side there, and around it too. It sets itself back from the street.
That's
there's
right.
some greenery there. It softens its impact on the streetscape.
And there's a charming little garden there. There was more space on the northern side at the time, and there was a wonderful little building called Felton Textiles next door unfortunately has gone. But this one's survived, and I don't think anybody's proposing to demolish it. And finished in glass, and this glass came from Belgium. And when the afternoon Australian sun hit the western end, it produced impurities in the glass, and the glass just shattered and fell.
Not made for Aussie conditions.
No. I can remember it having scaffolding all around the building. The people in Sydney had a good laugh at it. So
that would be a tricky repair.
It was. They had to replace all of the glass. Yeah. So and a lot of people said, "We told you so. We told you this was going to happen," and they were right. Yeah.
The architect here was who?
This was Bates Smart, and the chief architect, Mr. McCutcheon, Bates Smart and McCutcheon, they were at the time. He'd spent a lot of time working with the American troops during the war, and so he had an idea of how these buildings should be. He developed one called Hume House up in William Street, which was a lovely little building, but it was sort of the test case for this building, because ICI wanted a big feature building. They were a British chemical company, and a lot of our buildings in those days were still being funded by the British, and particularly the insurance companies. So down Queen Street, all along there was a whole lot of insurance companies there.
That's the other tale, isn't it, in cities, is the tracing the money, the lines of capital.
That's right, yeah. Robin's heard me say many times, it all comes back to money. She'd be disappointed if I didn't say it.
It is good, though, just standing here with this building. As you say, it would create howls of protest, and rightly so, if anything was to happen here. And it's active. It would still appear to offer the appurtenances of a modern office space. Yeah. Those things are not beyond it.
It's been reworked a few times internally. And I think Bates Smart is still there, and a number of other commercial organisations are in there. But I mean, it's such a simple, elegant building. It could have been built yesterday, and it would have stood up hopefully in the public eye, certainly in the eye of fans of this style.
Robin, thank you. And fans of this style are growing.
Well, I hope so. We're doing our best. Hopefully the book will introduce a few more people to it, because I think it's important to get the stories behind the buildings, which is what I try to do and what we've been talking about too. So a building just doesn't appear out of nowhere on a skyhook. No. There's a whole lot of things happen to make sure that it gets constructed.
And they have a social and an aesthetic context, which is important.
Yeah. So thank you, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Nice stroll.